I stood on the porch of my house, juggling groceries, when I caught sight of the little black dot of the Ring camera. For a moment, I hesitated. It had been installed back when my ex-husband, Matt, and I lived together. I'd forgotten all about it after the divorce. Part of me wondered if he still had access, but I brushed the thought away. He wouldn't. He shouldn't. Right? That night, I curled up on the couch trying to shake off the uneasy feeling. It was late when the first knock came, soft but insistent. When I opened the door, a man stood there, tattooed from the crown of his head to his neck. His face was a chaotic masterpiece of inked lines and symbols, dark and hypnotic. His eyes locked onto mine, and I froze. Something about him, his presence, his aura, sent a shiver down my spine.
"I couldn't help noticing your beautiful house," he said, his voice smooth, low. "It's lonely around here, isn't it?"
I should have been scared. I should have slammed the door and called the police. But instead, I felt a spark of something I hadn't felt in years. Danger, intrigue, maybe desire. We exchanged words I can't even recall, and then he was gone. The next night, I heard the knock again, and the next. Each time, I opened the door just a little wider. He introduced himself as Arnold. He wasn't like anyone I'd ever met. Unapologetically wild, brimming with chaos. I should have been repelled, but instead, I was drawn to him. One evening, he brought out a marker, a simple Sharpie, he called it.
"Let me show you something," he said, his voice a hypnotic whisper.
And then he began to draw. On my hand at first, the dark ink curling into elegant spirals and fierce patterns. The marker's tip dragging across my skin sent jolts of electricity down my spine. It felt good. Too good.
"It suits you," he murmured,
his breath warm against my ear.
"You're a blank canvas waiting to be transformed."
Somewhere in the back of my mind, I knew this was insane. I knew Matt would lose his mind if he knew what I was doing. But that only made it better. Arnold's touch, the permanence of his art, it awakened something deep, primal, and uncontrollable in me. Every night after that, I craved more, craved him. One night, he invited me to his shed. It wasn't a normal shed. It was his studio. The walls were plastered with sketches, photographs, and tattoo designs.
"Stand here," he said, his voice commanding but not unkind. And I obeyed, feeling an intoxicating mix of fear and excitement.
Then he proceeded to tie me. He began to work, the marker gliding over my skin like fire and ice. My arms, my legs, my face. Nothing was off limits. I felt alive under his touch, transformed by every stroke of ink. I didn't care that it wasn't normal. I didn't care that it wasn't right. It was mine. And then it all shattered. It was Matt who ruined everything. He barged into the shed with a cop, his face twisted with fury and fear. He saw me there, tied down, covered in Arnold's art, and he froze.
"Lacey! What the hell has he done to you?"
Arnold dropped the marker and raised his hands, playing the part of the submissive villain. But I knew better. Arnold wasn't hurting me. He was giving me what I wanted. Matt didn't understand. He never did. He untied me, his hands shaking, muttering apologies as if I were some victim.
"It hurts,"
I cried, the words spilling from my mouth. But it wasn't the ink. It was the thought of leaving Arnold, of losing the only person who truly saw me. They took me to the hospital. The doctors poked and prodded, trying to scrub off the ink, but they couldn't. They called it permanent. I called it freedom. Matt tried to talk to me afterward. He wanted to get back together. He wanted to save me. But how could he save me when I didn't want to be saved? Now, I stand in front of the mirror every day, tracing the lines of Arnold's art on my skin. I remember his touch, his voice, the way he made me feel like I belonged. Matt doesn't understand. He's lost, devastated, broken. He still calls sometimes, his voice shaking, begging me to come back. But I can't.
because every time I look in the mirror, I see the woman I've always wanted to be. And I'll never give that up. Not for Matt, not for anyone.
I never thought my life would end up like this. Tied to a chair in a filthy basement, bruised, battered, and barely clinging to sanity. The person I once loved, trusted, and supported, my boyfriend, was the reason I was here. His selfishness, his lies, and his inability to keep a simple promise had put me in this nightmare. It all started with that McDonald's trip. I had no idea he'd broken his diet. I worked so hard to help him get back in shape. Not just for me, but for his health, his confidence. I knew he needed motivation. And maybe my words were harsh, but they were necessary. I thought he understood how important this was. But no, he chose greasy burgers and fries over discipline. And worse, he chose his shame over my safety. When that officer came to the door on Saturday, I could feel something was off. His smile didn't reach his eyes, and his questions felt rehearsed, not genuine. But I brushed it off, assuming it was just a routine inquiry about Jim's disappearance. I didn't know that my idiot boyfriend had seen something horrifying and kept it to himself to cover up his midnight binge. I didn't know that monster standing on our doorstep was a murderer. Well, the officer returned that evening while my boyfriend was out sulking at McDonald's. I had no idea he was the same man dragging a corpse through the yard. He seemed concerned, even charming, as he asked me more questions about Jim. He offered to drive me to the station to go over a few things in more detail. He was a policeman, why wouldn't I trust him? I agreed without hesitation. I never made it to the station. Instead, I ended up here, in this hellhole. The first few hours were the worst. He tied me up and laughed as I screamed for help. He told me how my boyfriend had seen him that night, had watched him dragging Jim's body, and then went home to protect his precious secret. He mocked me, saying my boyfriend cared more about his image than my life. And the worst part, he was right. The days blurred into a twisted nightmare of fear, pain, and humiliation. He kept asking me how much I trusted my boyfriend. Every time I cried, every time I begged for mercy, he'd remind me that this was all my boyfriend's fault. "Your fatty couldn't even come forward to save his own skin," he sneered. "Now look at you, paying the price." The torture wasn't just physical, it was psychological. He wanted to break me, to make me despise the man I once loved. And as much as I hated myself for it, I started to believe him. My boyfriend could have stopped this. He could have called the police that night, told them everything, and saved me. Instead, he chose his secret over my safety, his guilt over my life. By the time the man abandoned me in the middle of a deserted field, I was barely alive. My wrists and ankles were raw from the ropes, my body ached from the beatings, and my mind felt like it had been shattered into pieces. I wandered for hours before a truck driver found me and took me to the hospital. I'm alive, but I'll never be the same. The scars on my body will fade eventually, but the scars on my soul never will. I can't stop thinking about the moment I realized my boyfriend had seen the killer and done nothing. He didn't save me. He didn't even try. I blame him for all of this. If he hadn't been so weak, if he hadn't lied, if he'd just been honest, I wouldn't have been taken. I wouldn't have been tortured. My life wouldn't be a shell of what it used to be. I'm done with him. I don't care how much he cries or apologizes. I don't care if he spends the rest of his life hating himself. I'm done sacrificing my happiness and safety for someone who doesn't value me. He let me down when it mattered most, and I'll never forgive him for that. It all started with the coffee. a bitter, burnt-tasting sludge that the office kitchen dared to call an energy booster. I remember staring at the brown liquid swirling in my cup one Friday morning, thinking how much I hated everything about this place. My boss, my coworkers, the endless demands. But what really pushed me over the edge wasn't any of that. It was the donuts. Every week, I was the one tasked with picking up a box of sugary confections to boost morale. As if a sprinkle-covered lump of dough could fix the fact that we were all dying in cubicles, bleeding time and dignity for a paycheck. Week after week, I'd be forced to endure their fake smiles and hollow gratitude. It was humiliating. But this Friday was different. I woke up with clarity, a plan. It wasn't impulsive, no. This had been growing inside me for months. I'd been researching, planning, perfecting. I knew the exact dosage, the precise timing. All I needed was an opportunity. The boy at Dunkin' didn't suspect a thing. He was always overly eager, trying to chat with me about my work, my day, whatever. I guess he thought he was being nice, but it made me want to shove his grinning face into the coffee machine. I played along, as usual, and left with the box of donuts. I could feel the weight of them in my hands, heavier than usual because of what I was about to do. In the parking lot, I prepared everything. A can of poison was already in the glove compartment. My hands didn't shake as I sprinkled the powder evenly over the donuts, making sure every single one was laced. I worked methodically, like an artist adding the finishing touches to a masterpiece. When I was done, I tossed the can out the window. I didn't need it anymore. As I drove to the office, I imagined their faces when they ate, their laughter and small talk, the glazed stares and spasms as the poison took hold. It would be beautiful. Everything was going perfectly until I spotted the Dunkin' boy standing by the dumpsters. He was looking right at me, a cigarette dangling from his mouth. I froze, but then he turned away. For a second, I thought I was in the clear. I didn't know then how wrong I was. When I got to the office, I placed the donuts on the table in the break room like I always did. The vultures swarmed almost immediately, digging into their glazed prizes. I smiled, but inside I felt nothing. I didn't stay to watch. I had other things to do. About 20 minutes later, I got the text from Patrick. We have a problem. I met him in the hallway. He was jittery, his massive frame somehow trembling like a leaf. The boy from Dunkin', he saw you, I swore under my breath. Where is he now? In the lobby. He's trying to warn people. My mind raced. Bring him to the conference room. I'll handle it. Patrick nodded and left. I made my way there, rehearsing what I'd say, how I'd make him disappear. By the time Patrick shoved the boy into the room, I had it all figured out. Steve and I have a plan, Patrick blurted, and I shot him a glare. Idiot. Why give anything away? The boy was panicking, shouting something about calling the cops, but I wasn't worried. I stepped closer to him, holding one of the donuts I'd saved for this exact moment. Forget the others, I told Patrick. We'll pin it all on this little hero. The boy's face twisted in fear as I lunged forward, shoving the donut into his mouth. He thrashed and gagged, but I held his nose, forcing him to chew. His eyes bulged with terror, and for a moment, I felt alive. And then the door slammed open. A cop stood there, gun drawn. My heart sank. The boy spat the donut out onto the carpet and started blubbering his thanks. The cop didn't say a word as he cuffed me and Patrick. We didn't resist. What was the point? As we were led out of the room, I glanced back at the break room. My masterpiece had been interrupted, but not entirely ruined. Two bodies lay sprawled on the floor, their faces frozen in agony. At least I'd succeeded, partially. The boy was escorted out with us, his chest puffed out like he just saved the world. He wouldn't feel so smug for long. Months later, I watched the news from my prison cell. They were interviewing the Duncan boy, some local hero story about how he thwarted a mass poisoning. I smiled as I leaned back against the cold wall, feeling the weight of what I had just set in motion. What they didn't know was that I'd planned for this. The poison wasn't the only trick I had up my sleeve. In the weeks before my arrest, I'd been testing something far more insidious. A delayed neurotoxin. The boy had inhaled it the moment he had opened his mouth to scream, carried in the powdered sugar from the donut that I had shoved into his throat. He wouldn't notice it at first, but slowly, over weeks or months, it would eat away at him, driving him mad. Hallucinations, paranoia, the works. By the time he realized something was wrong, it'd be too late. I may have lost the battle, but the war was far from over.
After my friend's New Year's party, I was extremely drunk. I could barely stand as I waited outside my Uber. The car arrived, and it took me a long time to stumble into the back seat. The driver didn't seem to judge me. He greeted me like we were old friends, and as we were driving, he kept making small talk, even though I was barely able to answer his questions. A few minutes into the ride, he asked me about my sister Caroline, so he definitely knew who I was. But when I looked at his face in the rearview mirror, I didn't recognize him at all. He was probably about 15 years older than me. He looked bloated and sloppy. I pulled out my phone to see what his name was on the app, but I couldn't focus my eyes enough to read. So I just asked him, "Who are you?" He muttered, "You don't remember me?" He seemed genuinely offended. I apologized, blaming my intoxication, but I don't think my words came out right. He seemed angry, and when I called him sir out of politeness, he absolutely flipped. "I'm Vincent," he screamed at me. The car swerved. I still didn't know who he was. The only Vincent I could remember was my high school boyfriend. He was the hottest guy at our school, and I really liked him at the time. I don't remember why we broke up, but he ended up dating my friend Irene for the rest of high school. We lost touch after graduation. But this guy was much older and much uglier than I remember Vincent. "Sorry," I told him. "Are you my mom's friend?" "No, we dated in high school," he yelled as he swerved down the road. I couldn't see the odometer, but I felt like he was speeding up. This was the same Vincent, but I couldn't believe it. He used to be so hot. If I had been sober, I probably would have calmed him down with my words, but I wasn't sober, so I didn't say anything at all. His anger only got worse. He started ranting about how I ruined his life. If I hadn't broken up with him, he would have never have gotten back together with Irene. I guess he married her right after high school, and his life had been miserable ever since. I could definitely see that happening. Irene used to be one of my friends, and she was definitely a bitch. He screamed about how miserable he was, how I was the only thing that ever happened to him that was good. How he insulted me felt like I didn't even remember him. As he screamed, he kept turning around to look at me. His eyes weren't even on the road. "Please slow down," I begged him. He did not slow down. Instead, he smiled darkly and clicked on his seatbelt. I could tell from his expression that he was planning to crash the car. I reached for my seatbelt, but I couldn't find one. I didn't have seatbelts in the back seat. Ignoring my screams, he sped up even more and drove off the road. He was aiming for a tree, but I reached past him and grabbed the steering wheel. We narrowly missed the tree. The car careered down a steep incline before crashing into a trench that ran along the side of the road. Normally, the trench was bone dry, so if we crashed into it, we'd collide with the solid concrete. I'd be thrown out of the car, but Vincent's seatbelt and airbag would offer him a bit more protection. That's what I was thinking, at least. The trench wasn't dry. A solid river of ice-cold water running through it. We had a lot of snowfall on the mountain, but last week it was unexpectedly warmer, and I guess that explained the rushing water. I held tight onto the seat in front of me. My shoulders stuck to the side, but I don't think I broke anything. Neither did Vincent. He was twisting around in his seat, trying to unlock his seatbelt while the car filled with water rushing through the broken windshield. By this point, I felt completely sober. I pushed open the door and swam out. The trench wasn't as deep as I thought. The water only went up to my shoulders. It was pretty easy to climb up the ladder at the side of the trench. Once I climbed on the dry land, I looked down at the car, but Vincent still hadn't resurfaced. His seatbelt must have jammed. I was about to leave him to drown, but after all, he did do this to himself. But I wasn't that kind of person. I carefully lowered myself back into the water and waded towards the car. Vincent had managed to open his door, but he was still stuck under his seatbelt. The water was well over his head, and he wasn't moving. I fumbled with his seatbelt for less than a second before it clipped open. I'll never know why it was so easy for me to open when Vincent had been struggling with it for minutes. I pulled his limp body out of the car and brought him to the edge of the trench. A traffic cop had spotted the wreck from the road. He stood over us and helped me push Vincent's body out of the water. Then he administered mouth to mouth. Vincent spat out a bunch of water and gasped for air. He was alive. Two separate ambulances came and took us both to the hospital. I don't remember what happened after that. I woke up in a hospital bed with the same policeman sitting at my side. He said the doctors had examined me and that I didn't have any serious injuries. I asked him about Vincent. "He'll be fine," the cop said. "But I'm afraid you won't be able to see him. When we are recovering his vehicle, we found evidence of a crime in his trunk." He wasn't going to tell me anything else. "You're not going to tell me?" I asked, annoyed. "I almost died. I deserve to know the whole story." The cop looked at me straight in the eyes. "There was a body in the trunk. His wife, Irene."